This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Anthony Brooks and Meghna Chakrabarty. Congress considers military strikes against Syria, and a senator from Massachusetts votes present. The governor's race gets some new faces and old ones, and the race to replace Tom Menino heats up, too. We're talking about This Week in the News with Jim O'Sullivan, politics editor for Boston.com, and David Scharfenberg, politics and policy reporter here at WBUR. David and Jim, welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And let's start with the Syria news. So Secretary of State John Kerry and numerous other administration leaders, they made their pitch to the House and the Senate this week for authorization to conduct military strikes against Syria. And then today, President Obama announced that he will be addressing the nation on Tuesday about the Syria situation. But earlier this week, when it came to making the case to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, it was John Kerry who did that.
We're here because a dictator and his family's personal enterprise, in their lust to hold on to power, were willing to infect the air of Damascus with a poison that killed innocent mothers and fathers and hundreds of their children, their lives all snuffed out by gas in the early morning of August 21st.
The committee that heard that testimony voted 10-7 in favor of authorizing military action, with one senator, Massachusetts freshman Ed Markey, voting present. Now, Jim Sullivan, I'm interested in what you make of this vote, and we also had some chatter at work this week about why not abstain, why go with present. Can you explain this to us?
Sure. Well, Senator Markey's explanation was that he needed more time and he wanted more information. I think you saw a hint of that when he was questioning Secretary Kerry. He said, why not wait for more information? And that sort of signaled that he was going to be a little bit on the fence. It's a tough vote. Politically for Markey, it's a tough vote. President Obama came here to campaign for him. Secretary Kerry cleared the way in stepping down for Markey to get the Democratic nomination. And back home, this is, as it is back home for a lot of these senators and congressmen, it's an unpopular move. So he has said he's going to vote yes or no on the floor next week when it comes to the full Senate for a vote. But it was a move that I think surprised a lot of people who it was really Markey's first big vote since he came to the Senate, a place he'd been waiting to get for some 37 years. And I think a lot of people were looking for something more decisive from him.
And he really seems to be experiencing some fallout from that. I mean, if we think about Scott Brown, he wrote on his Facebook page, I did not agree with John Kerry on much, but at least he would have had the guts to vote. Markey said he needs more time to analyze the information. He sits on the committee that gets all the information. Unreal. Quote. Again, that was Scott Brown on his Facebook page. David Scharfenberg, do you anticipate there being some lasting political fallout for Markey on this, even reputationally?
I don't think it'll last too long. I mean, he's still got some time before his election, re-election. Not too much time. He's got to run again next year, our constant cycle of elections in Massachusetts. But look, this doesn't look good for him. I mean, John Kerry will never live down saying that he was for Iraq war spending before he was against it. This is essentially Markey saying I was for it before I weaseled out of it. So it doesn't look good, but he will be voting yay or nay next week.
There have been many other Massachusetts congressmen who have been much more emphatic that they are deciding one way or the other. One of them was Mike Capuano. He said he has heard the administration's case, but that yesterday he said he was leaning against voting for it.
I accept the argument that Assad probably did commit a war crime, and there should be consequences to that. However, that doesn't then say that the next consequence must be the United States acting on its own right now.
And he's hardly alone in that. Congressman Lynch, McGovern, Neal, Tierney, they've all said they're opposed in principle. I actually spoke this week with Jim McGovern on this show, and he said, look, I'm sorry to say that we're inconsistent in terms of when we intervene. We do it when it's convenient. We've turned a blind eye to atrocities in the past, like Sudan, and he just isn't convinced that military action is the solution. So, Jim O'Sullivan, do you think that given how dug in particular, people like McGovern seem, is the Massachusetts delegation set against this, or can they be convinced by further evidence?
You know, I think it's a fascinating question. Is the president and is John Kerry going to be able to peel off even one vote from the Massachusetts delegation? I think it's going to be interesting. I think they'll go after Congressman Neal. I think they'll go after Congressman Keating. And I think the White House put out a picture yesterday of Congressman Kennedy in the Situation Room with Vice President Biden getting briefed on Syria. But there's a chance that they could go 0-for for the entire delegation, which, considering the amount of political capital that the president has spent here, he's not costing himself anything in Massachusetts, but that he's invested here, he's come and campaigned on behalf of Senator Warren and Senator Markey. You could argue that the president's coattails were responsible last year for keeping Congressman Tierney in office. It's remarkable that they're going to have to work that hard. And it sort of speaks to the hill they have to climb across the country in Congress. It's a tough sell.
I mentioned that I talked to Congressman McGovern, and one of the first things he said out of the gate was, I'm just sick and tired of all these wars. Do you think, David Scharfenberg, that in many ways the Massachusetts delegation just reflects the mood of the country? They're tired of years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Is that why there's so much reluctance?
It does to some degree here, and I think there's some particular resistance on the left. It's interesting, in the race to fill Ed Markey's old seat in the House, Carl Shortino, one of the candidates there who sort of pitched himself as the true liberal in the race, is looking to make hay out of the Syria issue. He's got a conference call with a liberal congressman, Alan Grayson, in which he's going to kind of challenge his opponents to get in gear and to oppose the Syria effort. So on the left in particular, and Massachusetts is certainly on the left, this is a hot button issue.
So shifting from Syria to state politics, this week Charlie Baker announced he's running for governor, and he acknowledged that last time around he may not have let voters get to know him as well. He said, I sort of kept my family out of the public light. Maybe I needed to let people see me with my wife and kids, and voters didn't really quite connect. So here we have a piece of tape from him on Wednesday when he was talking about what will be his new approach to campaigning.
We had a lot of friends who came up to us after the race was over and said, you know, that Charlie Baker that I know, that sunny, positive, aim high, let's go climb the mountain guy, where was he?
So Jim O'Sullivan, how radically different is the Charlie Baker we're going to see this time around than the one who was defeated by Deval Patrick in 2010?
Well, I don't know about radically different, but he's going to emphasize, I think, a different side of himself. And he's sent a signal that he's going to soften his tone, modulate a little bit on policy. It's clearly a strategic decision that he's made. And I think he's going to cost himself. He'll pick up votes by sort of exposing this warmer, gentler side of himself and featuring his wife more prominently in the campaign, show the family side of himself. But there's also the question of, as you reintroduce yourself to voters, you're basically saying that last version that you saw that I presented as authentic wasn't really authentic, and this is the real me. So which one are voters supposed to believe? It's a bit of a gymnastics move for him, a little acrobatic, but if he is going to run again, I think he's sort of sussed out the electorate and said, this is what they want to see, and I'm going to try and show that side of myself.
There's also increasing chatter that Attorney General Martha Coakley is strongly considering entering this race. Now, after she lost to Scott Brown, people thought that was a name that would never be back in elective politics. But here it is, David Scharfenberg. How likely is it that that's going to happen? Where do things stand on that front?
It certainly looks like she's headed toward a run, as the Globe reported. She's got Doug Rubin, the kind of premier Democratic strategist, on board now as an unpaid advisor. I think, she has rebuilt her reputation in many ways since her train wreck of a campaign back in 2010. She's one of the more popular politicians in the state now. I think the real question for Democrats is, will that popularity hold up under the glare of a campaign? Should she get in here? And we'll see what happens.
The Boston Herald today put photos of Martha Coakley and Charlie Baker on their front page, and they had this great I love this line. It described them both as humbled hopefuls. And that made me think this really could be a fascinating race if they end up running against each other, because both of them, sort of recovering from the loss last time, having to rethink their approach to campaigning. Jim O'Sullivan, if it were these two, do you sort of share my fascination with their similar backgrounds and how that might play out in their campaigning?
No question. It's two great storylines. I think they were up against different circumstances last time. Baker was going to have to be a bit of a giant slayer. Even though the governor's poll numbers weren't terrific, it's still a heavily Democratic state. His would have been a surprise win, I think, if you look at this sort of the full trajectory of the campaign, whereas Attorney General Coakley, of course, was a heavy favorite in that campaign. And I think there are still some, it cuts a couple different ways within the party. There are some folks in the party who say, why would we dredge all that up again? We're going to have to hear the standing outside Fenway Park in the cold, shaking hands quote again.
That infamous line by Martha Coakley, right?
Right, and how she sort of intimated that Curt Schilling was a Yankees fan. But then there are also folks who say, look, she ran a lousy campaign by her own admission, but she's done a good job. She's rehabilitated herself. And we as a party didn't give her the support that she needed. We sort of took that race for granted, and we owe her one. So there are a couple different schools of thought on that.
Besides the race for governor, there's, of course, a race for mayor here in Boston. Just 18 days from now, voters go to the polls for the preliminary election to replace Mayor Menino. 12 candidates in the running, so pretty fierce competition at this point. Could David or Jim, could one of you sort of first remind us procedurally what gets decided on September 24th? For people who haven't paid attention, are we whittling this down to two candidates? What happens on that date?
Yeah, I can take that. That's exactly the case. We'll be whittling the field from 12 to 2. It's a preliminary election. And then after that, you'll have a final election in November between those two finalists.
So we're going to drop the size of that field very dramatically in
just
a few weeks. Now, this week, Dan Conley, one of the candidates, the Suffolk County DA, released four new short spots in a slew of ads coming out. Here's part of one of them.
All the candidates talk about jobs. The difference? Dan Conley has a Better Jobs Now plan that creates jobs and real opportunity for all of Boston.
David Scharfenberg, you've been reviewing some of these ads. Which ones do you see getting the most traction so far?
It's interesting. Dan Conley is one of the more moneyed candidates in the race. He's been running ads for much longer than any of the other candidates. He's continuing on some of these same themes of education and jobs, as you just heard. I think the challenge for him is, as a district attorney, as a lawman, making the argument that he can be the guy to deliver real reform in education and to deliver it on jobs. But we are certain to see a blossoming of ads in the final weeks here. And there have been some interesting ones out there.
Jim, there was some very good reporting this week in the Globe about the minority candidates in the race. Of course, 6 of the 12 are minorities. And there was a story today about how backers of Charlotte Golar Richie, the only female in the race, took some heat this week because they want to try to narrow the field even of minority candidates even before they get to the preliminary. So tell us about what the sort of conflict within the minority community is over that.
Right, and I would suggest that there's even conflict among Richie supporters about whether this was handled properly or whether it was done a little bit ham-handedly. Look, it's always tough. We're still dealing with ethnic politics, right? And there are different tribes within the city. Call that lack of progress, call it natural politics, call it what you will, but there, you know, this takes place within every community. People look at the field and they say it's happening now in the governor's race, where part of Coakley's thinking is, okay, if I get in now, I would be the best-known woman in the race. There's only one other woman in the race, Juliette Kayyem. And Capuano's looking around and he's saying, well, maybe I have a chance to peel off labor support. What's going on in the mayoral campaign is because it is such a condensed electorate and it's going to be such a finite number of votes. People are talking in the 100,000 realm of votes on September 24th. You're sort of weighing your natural constituencies as a candidate and saying, okay, how can I maximize that natural constituency? And if it were the Irish candidates who were trying to knock each other out, I think it would be a similar controversy. In this case, it's the African-American candidates, the black candidates who are trying to knock each other out. So there's a natural tension there, I think, between campaigns and between candidacies. And there are different philosophies even within blocks of supporters. Is this the right thing to do? Should we have a maximum number of candidates to maximize our vote, or should we sort of consolidate behind one? So it is sort of fraught with tension. There's old neighborhood rivalries that have flared up around it. It's interesting, and I think you'll see probably some more of this as the campaign goes on.
There seems to be a sense that Charlotte Golar Richie hasn't been campaigning as vigorously as people hope she would, you know, given a very sort of accomplished background in politics, given the natural appeal she would have to many voters for being the only woman and a woman of color. Do you, David and Jim, I'm interested in both your thoughts on this. Is there a sense that it's been a lackluster campaign? And would it get better if she became one of the finalists?
She has faced that critique. It's haunted her for weeks now, and certainly she'd have a. She still has the potential, I think, a lot of observers believe, to have that one breakout week where she kind of surges up because she is the only woman in the race, because she is one of the a handful of viable minority candidates. So I wouldn't count her out yet, but that certainly has been floating around the campaign.
The other Connolly in the race, the Connolly rather than the Conley, John Connolly campaigned in front of the Apple Store on Boylston Street on Wednesday, and he said that City Hall should run more like an Apple Store.
City Hall is closer to the old school registry of motor vehicles than it is to the Apple Store today, and that means we've got a lot of room for improvement. And I think it starts with putting everything online, making sure we're fully accessible online, but you've also got to bring a user-friendly, customer-friendly approach to everything we do in city government.
David, is that partly an appeal to young people? Is this a message that's going to resonate with voters?
It is. One of the fascinating trends in this race, I think, is there are several candidates who want to be the blank candidate. Innovation candidate is one of them. You've got Mike Ross saying the word innovation whenever he can. You've got John Connolly standing in front of an Apple Store. However a candidate tries to distinguish him or herself, there's someone else who's trying to do the same.
Another Globe story I want to mention, also from today's paper, Jim O'Sullivan, is this really interesting story about a little brouhaha going on over who should host next year's St. Patrick's Day breakfast in South Boston. Linda Dorsina-Forey, now a state senator. She, this spring, had been a rep, won an election for senator, married to Bill Forey, editor of the Dorchester Reporter. She's, again, expressed the assumption she'll be hosting, and that hasn't gone over well with everyone in South Boston political establishment. Jim, tell us about that.
Yeah, it's really a sort of a sense of the Southie tradition of this has always been a Southie breakfast up against sort of this idea that someone from outside the neighborhood, it's not just a matter of color. Linda Dorsina-Forey is Haitian American. It's also that the idea that the breakfast, if not physically, at least spiritually, is moving beyond the neighborhood. She's from Dorchester and represents a state Senate seat that has both Southie and Dorchester and Mattapan and Hyde Park. Full disclosure, I worked for the Forey family, my first job out of college over at the neighborhood newspaper company that they own. But it's really going to be interesting to see how the mayoral candidates react. Do they make the judgment, those who are going hard in Southie, particularly John Conley and Marty Walsh, do they make the judgment that it's better to sort of play to Southie's pride and say we want to keep this a South Boston breakfast and that Bill Linehan, the city councilor there, or Nick Collins, the state rep, should host, or do we want to broaden a little bit and expand a little bit and Linda Dorsina-Forey should host? And I think I talked to a member of the Boston delegation today who said that the breakfast runs a real risk if it is sort of cloistered in with Southie and that it's only South Boston people who can host it, that it runs a real risk of turning people off and having – you'll have – you know, regular attendees, you see state reps from far-flung suburbs come in from Western Mass who drive in, people who say they don't want to be associated with that sort of a tightly held neighborhood-centric type of event. So it's going to be fascinating to watch how the candidates up and down the ballot react to this.
An abrupt pivot to sports, because there were a lot of developments on the local sports scene that I want to build in some time for. The New England Patriots, of course, kick off their season against the Buffalo Bills on Sunday in New York. Now, the team will not have notable former star Aaron Hernandez. He was arraigned in court earlier today on first-degree murder charges.
Aaron Hernandez, on 2013-90, the who did assault and beat Odin Lloyd, intent to murder, and by such assault and beating, did kill and murder, it said Odin Lloyd, in violation of General Laws, Chapter 265, Section 1. As to this indictment, sir, how do you plead?
Not guilty.
At this point, can the team move beyond this tragic off-season drama that's really surrounding the state, this case? I'm interested in how the two of you think this will affect the team, if at all, in any way this season.
You know, I was sitting next to a coworker today who said, seems like Aaron Hernandez is getting arraigned every day. He keeps making these court appearances. And I think people are starting to tire on the story already a little bit, if you can believe that, and turn toward the football season. There was a story in the Globe actually today about how the Patriots brand is held up despite this tumultuous offseason. Polling showing it's still the most popular team in the region. Every game this season is already sold out. If these guys can keep winning, and Tom Brady tends to win, I think they're going to be just fine.
Another high-profile player who will not be starting the game, although it wasn't a high-profile player on the team for long, is Tim Tebow. Now, for people who only tangentially pay attention to sports but still recognize that Tim Tebow at least used to be a gigantic name, Jim O'Sullivan, are you familiar enough with this to tell us what happened there?
Well, I think what happened is that Tim Tebow was not up to the caliber of NFL quarterback that certainly we've been accustomed to around here for the last, even before Brady with Drew Bledsoe. He just doesn't have it as an NFL quarterback. He doesn't have that skill set. There's no question he's a phenomenal athlete. I saw that he got an offer from the USA Rugby Association or the American Rugby Association. He's a terrific athlete, and he's a fascinating guy. I think you saw when he threw those touchdowns in the preseason game, the sidelines just erupted. His teammates loved him, and he came over, and they were hugging him and pointing at the scoreboard, and he's clearly a likable guy, but he does not, I think, have the talent specific to an NFL quarterback, and I think we've seen that. He got an offer from another team to come and play something else, whether it be special teams or tight end, I'm not sure, and he said no, he wants to be an NFL quarterback. Now, there is the chance that he could come back to the Pats. You know, they sign him, he goes unsigned by another team, he could come back to the Patriots, but he's somebody who would need to go. If he wants to play quarterback in the NFL, he really needs to go and learn how to throw like an NFL quarterback and learn how to recognize situations like an NFL quarterback.
In more positive news, Red Sox, that's quite positive there, especially after last night's New York Yankees win. Two of you have any sense of whether this time they will avoid a collapse like last season?
It seems like it seems like the karma has really shifted here. I mean, you know, everything went wrong last year. This year you had just a couple nights ago, David Ortiz getting his 2000th hit, and they're playing the theme from The Natural, you know, the Robert Redford film as he stands on second base.
Everything, in his home stadium.
Right. Everything seemed to go their way. So, you know, perhaps the curse has been lifted and perhaps we should expect good things. I don't know.
I tell you what, watching the game last night, I got a little sense of deja vu. It was not the, the stakes weren't as high as they were in 04, but having the swing from your heels guy in Mike Napoli in 04 is Kevin Millar, who drew a walk. Napoli up against Mo Rivera in the bottom of the ninth with two strikes, two outs, gets the big hit. Then we get this guy who's specifically brought on the team to steal bases, steals the big base. I don't know. And then we scored another run off Jabba. It's feeling very similar to that team of destiny, isn't it?
It is.
David Scharfenberg and Jim O'Sullivan, you've both been with us before on Week in Review, so you know at the end of the segment we do our hubbubs, a story that would have fallen through the cracks or maybe did fall through the cracks for some people. David, let's start with you. Have you picked a hubbub for this week?
I have. Mayor Menino, known as a well-intentioned guy who's never been the greatest of wordsmiths, so perhaps it's appropriate that his what may be his final splash on the national scene is an interview with the New York Times Magazine in which he suggested that he would blow up Detroit and start all over.
Unfortunate verb.
It was. The mayor of Detroit was not none too pleased with that, but Mayor Menino's people explained that he just meant, you know, fix the place, and I'm sure that is what he meant. But a fitting close, perhaps, to his national...
He's consistent.
Yeah, right. That's the truth.
And Jim O'Sullivan, your hubbub?
Yeah, I'll go political, too, and mine's purely speculative. But with Charlie Baker in the news again this week and the gubernatorial field starting to form for 2014, think back to 4 years ago when Tim Cahill decided to unenroll from the Democrats and take steps towards running for governor in 2010. What if Tim Cahill had stuck around as treasurer and done another 4 years? He'd have several million dollars in the bank. He could be seen as he'd be a statewide office holder. Steve Grossman would not be state treasurer in all likelihood. And Tim Cahill could be seen as a front runner for the Democratic nomination for 2014. Instead, he's an afterthought in Massachusetts politics.
Mm. I think we have enough time left that I'm going to mention two things that caught my eye. One was a Globe editorial this week about this British author who's written a new crime novel called Jamaica Plain. Now, what's funny about this is that he apparently has described it as the face of Middle America, which JP is is far from. So this is a guy who clearly didn't know our JP very well. He apparently did most of his research on Google Maps, but that book is out there. The guy's name is either Colin Campbell or Colin Campbell, called Jamaica Plain. And also, the T, you might have heard, has put together this safety video. It's a safety and courtesy video where they're trying to get people to, you know, not put your backpack on the seat next to you and don't be talking on a cell phone and make sure you hold on to the escalator rails. And it's this they're going to put these on digital ads in certain stations and also have accompanying posters and buses. So we have a little piece of that. It's this public service announcement from the T.
Now watch me bounce. Will you ride while I ride it out, I do the safety bounce. When you ride it out, bounce when you ride.
So as you're hearing, the refrain says, just bounce when you ride it out. I'm not actually sure how effective that refrain is in terms of getting across the safety and courtesy message, but that's what they've done, so that's what we have.
Right. I read that the woman who wrote that said she was thinking of Dr. Dre, I think, when she was putting it together. I'm not sure if it quite rises to that level. Jay-Z, maybe? I forget.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't mind if the T turned his attention to getting cell phone reception in the tunnels instead of coming up with new jingles.
Rather than spending time and money on videos.
Yeah.
David Scharfenberg is politics and policy reporter here at WBUR. Jim O'Sullivan is the politics editor for Boston.com. Thanks very much to both of you for joining us in our weekly Week in Review.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Up next, we'll be talking with the author of this year's One City, One Story selection. This is a story that about 30,000 copies of it are going to be distributed around the city for free, kind of a big community book club, basically. The story is called Karma. We're going to talk to the author about what it's about and how she thinks it connects to Boston. That's coming up next. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.
When you ride it out, do the safety bounce. When you ride it out, bounce.